Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. It's Christmas week, so we've got a special Charles Dickens program for you. Our host will be Andrea Warren, who is a local author, and her topic is why Charles Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol. We're going to go into the Victorian age during this show and talk all about A Christmas Carol and Dickens himself and his family and the times. This program was recorded on Sunday, December the 7th of 2014 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. And we'll have our usual format today. We'll hear from Ms. Warren, and then we will take a short break, and then we'll have some questions from the audience. Let's go right to the introduction. Again, you're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the forum at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. The decorations were not done by the forum, but they fit perfectly the theme of our forum today. Today we have quite a different kind of thing in honor of it being near holiday time and the much loved ghost story, A Christmas Carol. We've invited Andrea Warren to speak. She's a local author who has written 7 books for young readers. I asked her what that meant, and she said ages 8 to 14. Andrea has written, her most recent book has been Charles Dickens and the Street Children of London. And so she is going to tell something about Dickens and comment more about why it is that he wrote A Christmas Carol.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's really a pleasure to be here at the Unitarian Church. I have attended irregularly. I was a longtime member of the Lawrence Unitarian Fellowship, and I'm always very happy to be among Unitarians. I'm going to assume that quite a few of you in the audience, if not all of you, love Dickens, or you wouldn't be here. And maybe you've seen it this year at the Rep. I have. I go every year. There seem to be some stories we can never hear too many times, and since its publication in 1843, A Christmas Carol has continued to make best lists, any kind you can name. It is officially considered a short story, though if you ask an eighth grader if that's a short story, they'll tell you it's a long story. But it's so much shorter than any of Dickens' other works, and certainly at the time it was classified as a short story. I'll get into that more later, but I have gotten very attached to Charles Dickens, and when I first started this project, I wasn't very fond of him at all. I didn't actually read one of his books until I got into graduate school, and I was doing a master's in British literature, and then I got a big dose of Dickens. But I got him here, and then I got him here, and then I got him here, and nobody was ever trying to connect dots between the books. I don't know if that's just something about the way we teach literature in the United States. I do know that that's not at all how it's done in the British Isles, or certainly by professors who have studied a little bit more about Dickens and know about the themes in his books and how he was using them. And so some of this may come as a surprise to you. Maybe it won't. I lived in London the fall of 2007. I was teaching there. And I had written, by that point, had 4, going on 5 books published for my audience. And incidentally, that audience may start at age 8, but it goes clear through seniorhood. These books are widely used in lots of venues, ESL courses for adults, for example, because my books are very intense story. They always have a child at the center of the story, but then it's set in something that's happening in history, the orphan trains, the Vietnam War, whatever it is. And I hope you will look at them when you're out in the lobby, and I'm always happy to talk about them. I write for this audience because I consider it the most challenging, and it gives me a great deal of pleasure. I'm a former school teacher, former magazine editor, former journalist, and now full-time book author. And I have always found myself enamored of fifth graders. I didn't teach them. I taught high school. But once I got to know them better, I couldn't resist them. It really is true that none of us are smarter than fifth graders. And they just are the best audience in the world. And I write nonfiction in part because of my journalism background. It's a writing form I love, but I also love history. So I've managed to bring together my interest in young people, my interest in literature, my interest in history, and of course my love of writing. So Charles Dickens is the first famous person I've ever written about. The book that will be coming out this next year is actually about the childhood of Buffalo Bill, and that has taken me into my second famous person. Buffalo Bill grew up right in this area on a homestead up near Leavenworth, and his family was very much caught up in the border war. And there's just this amazing story about this boy who, of course, grew up to be the most famous American in the world, founder of the Wild West Show, but so much had happened to him in childhood that had to do with everything else. So it's his childhood that I focused on. And with Charles Dickens, that turned out to be the case, too. I know a little bit about it, but that fall when I was in London, one of the things they do in that city, those of you who visited are probably aware of this, they do a lot of historic walks. And these walks will last anywhere from, I don't know, an hour and a half to 3 hours. Sometimes they're a half day or something. And so there was a walk that was a one-time-only thing called the London Foundling. And since I'd written about American foundlings, I thought I'd like to know it. You know, here we had the orphan trains to deal with a lot of the street children. What did they do in the British Isles? And so I went to this walk. It was a very gray, rainy November day. It was cold. It was windy. And it would have been real easy to stay home, but the Brits don't stay home. They dress for the weather. They don't let anything keep them at home. So I bundled up and headed off to one of the underground stations where we were meeting, and there was a small group of us because of that weather. But what a time we had. So we started out through the oldest district of London, around St. Paul's and Fleet Street and so forth, and I'm listening to the guys. There were two of them. One was a librarian and one was a teacher, and they kept talking about Charles Dickens. I had thought going into this that some of it I already could figure out. I knew we'd probably see Great Ormond Street Hospital for children, which was the first hospital to ever service slum children. We did indeed go by the home of the first surgeon who took care of those children. You know, some things like that that were kind of obvious. But even when our guides were talking about those things, they were still talking about Charles Dickens. And finally, at a break, I went over to one of them and I said, you know, what is it that you're saying about Charles Dickens? Because the topic was foundling children. And this woman said to me, you know, they always kind of look at, they like Americans, they really like us, but we're not real smart. There's so many things we just don't know. And so there's always this sort of tone of voice, there often is, where they're sort of like petting a dog on the head, and that's what was going on here. And she said, you know, in America, you study Charles Dickens as an author. Here, we study him as the great reformer. We study him as the greatest reformer. And right after she said that to me, we had reached the Foundling Hospital Museum, and I learned that Dickens was a patron of this, helping these street children who were having a good place to grow up, a limited number, but a wonderful charity nonetheless, and I do write about it in my book. And I was so curious about what she'd said to me that at that point I already had my credentials at the British Library because I was working on another thing at that time. So when I got there the next day, I started going back through early newspapers and journals and things that, since I tried to reproduce that research here and couldn't, were simply available to me there, and started reading about what conditions really were like when Dickens was a young man making his way in London, and what it was like for the poor, and what Dickens was doing. So I'm going to tell you just a little bit about him by way of background, for those of you who might not remember some of the story of Dickens himself. Daniel, I'm not getting it to progress. Oh, okay, I got it. This is just a drawing to show you, sort of representative of Dickens in his 20s, when he was a young man, very well dressed, which I think this tells you, walking through the slums. This is something that was a daily habit of his. He often walked 20 miles a day. And what he was doing was not only thinking, and a lot of us walk to solve problems, to work on issues, and he did this every day, but also because he was absorbing the stories that were around him. So this is a typical scene you would have seen. This was a gin palace. These were everywhere at the time. The water used for drinking in the slums of London, the huge slums of London, was from the Thames, and that was also the source of the only sewer in London. And so the water was contaminated, and people would therefore drink gin. Small children, right on through adults. It caused a lot of early deaths. It was very destructive, but, you know, they didn't have an alternative in because they didn't have clean water. So these are the kinds of things he was seeing. And this is the age when I really start focusing in on Dickens. He was a very, very good-looking man, medium build. He had large hazel eyes. He always wore the most stylish clothes. He would actually walk through the slums wearing white pants, often with a velvet jacket. And you can see his hair is a little longer because this was the style at the time. But whatever the style was, that's what he was wearing. But that's not where he started. So some of you may know that he worked in a factory as a child. And what really happened to him, and this is significant to everything he did with his life, he was born into the middle class. His father worked as a naval pay clerk. But his father had grown up on one of those big estates like Downton Abbey and had grown up in the servants' quarters. His father, Charles Dickens' grandfather, was a butler. The grandmother was a housekeeper. And he saw what these people had. He saw how they entertained. He saw how they dressed. And John Dickens wanted this. But he was a naval pay clerk, and he couldn't afford it. And consequently, he was always in debt. And the family had to constantly move around because of that. Dickens grew up with two sisters and two brothers. There had been two other children in the family who had died, who were younger than Dickens, and that had no doubt really traumatized the family. That was a very common event then, of course, but still would be very hard on any family. Finally, the father decided that maybe he could make his way in London. So when Dickens was 10 years old, he moved his family into London, and all they could live in was a rather poor little house, and they actually rented out one of the rooms just to have a little rent money coming in. And everything was a scramble. Dickens' older sister, Fanny, was a musical prodigy. And so she was able to go to the Royal Academy of Music, but the parents still had to pay part of that. They had to pay part of the tuition. So anything they could scrape together or John Dickens could borrow went to pay the tuition for the eldest daughter. And it left nothing for the other children. So right behind Fanny, you have this boy, Charles, who wants more than anything to go to school. He knew how to read because his mother had taught him. Both parents knew how to read and write, which in that day is saying something. And the mother probably had a little bit more education over that. We don't really know. But Dickens was not allowed to go to school. There wasn't money for tuition. He spent his days trying to help out at home, walking the streets, writing little stories and sketches about things he saw. He just took it all in. He was like a sponge. When he was 12, his father was arrested for debt. And at that time, and you know, there's talk about bringing this back in America, he was put in debtor's prison. So you go into debtor's prison and you don't come out until that debt's paid. Now, you know, they never quite dealt with that topic of how do you pay the debt when you're in prison, but there it is. So the mother had a very tough decision to make at that point. She had they were losing the house, they couldn't keep it, they had sold everything they had, every book, anything they could get, even pennies for. So what was going to happen now to the family, because they were going to be on the street? So they had two options. One option was to go to the workhouse. And if you've ever studied a Victorian workhouse or if you've read Oliver Twist, then you know what horrible, dismal places they were. Almost 100% fatality rates for children always in those places. And her other option was to take her three younger children, Dickens' younger sister and two brothers, and move into John Dickens' prison cell with him. It was an 8-by-12-foot cell with one high little window up on the wall and a tiny little fireplace. And they chose the prison because the workhouses were so terrible. So the mother took the three younger children, moved into the prison cell, and Charles Dickens, was put to work in a boot blacking factory down on the Thames. It was a beat-up old building full of rats and this sort of thing. So this little illustration shows you Dickens doing his work. He was horrified. He, at this point, till age 12, had been part of the middle class, and he was put to work among orphan boys and lower class. Everybody was working class except him. him. The boys gave him a real hard time about that. He dressed better. He spoke better. He tried to keep himself clean. You know, things that just weren't part of the common life at all. This was a really, really tough period for Dickens. It lasted about 2 years. I've never seen actual dates on this. When he was an adult, he didn't remember exactly, but about 2 years. And the labor was 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. As Dickens would learn later, what he was doing compared to what a lot of children were doing who were laborers was easy. He could sit. He had a roof over his head. Nobody was standing there with, hitting him because he wasn't working fast enough or that kind of thing. He had a break in the afternoon. He was making a little bit of money. The money that he made went to pay for lodging for him. He stayed in one of these children's boarding houses, buying his own food and anything else he, of course, gave to his mother. So this is how he spent these 2 years. And he knew, as he wrote later, and he wrote very little about his life. He was a very private person in many respects. And the most autobiographical of his books is David Copperfield, but you have to piece some things together. And he did write a section that I relied on heavily when I was doing my book about his childhood, and particularly about this period when he was working in the bootblack factory, because he was so horrified that now he's going to be considered low class. And he'd always been taught that they were diseased and that they were undeserving. You know, the Church of England at that time very much had this whole thing that you're born into the class God wants you in, and you're supposed to stay there and never complain and never try to better yourself. And this was in part devised so that the poor would continue to work, which would increase the fortunes of the wealthy. The wealthy had very little interest in the poor. I mentioned the workhouses. These were charities of the church parishes. The government did absolutely nothing. When Queen Victoria was on the throne, she had a great deal more interest in animals and abusive animals than she ever did in children. So with Dickens, he knew that he was very close to becoming one of the street children he saw every single day. This was hard. You know, he liked walking around the city and so forth, but this was although this picture was taken during the same period in New York City, it's showing what Dickens would have been seeing at that time, a homeless child trying to sleep on the street, ragged clothing, and so forth. And this is the kind of thing that Dickens was escaping. So I'm going to stop on this that shows the factory children at the mercy of overseers here, because I'm going to tell you very quickly what happened to Dickens. So from 12 to 14, he worked as a bootblack. Then his grandmother conveniently died, his father's mother, and she left just enough money to get John Dickens out of prison, get the family back into a rental house, and with just enough left over for Charles Dickens to be able to go to school. His mother wanted him to continue to work in a factory, but the father said, oh no, you know, this is a very bright boy. He needs to go back to school. Dickens really loved his parents. I want to add that real quickly. He was very devoted to them, and he took care of them all of their lives. And his father was forever a spendthrift in debt. So that was a bit of a burden. Charles Dickens once said that the only thing he ever inherited was relatives. And he was supporting a great deal of people. One of his sons later said, there's only one Charles Dickens ever born in a generation. None of his children could live up to their father. That's always been books have been written about that. You know, he had 10 children. One died in infancy and one died as a young adult in an accident. But the other eight grew to adulthood and were very dependent on their father for income, with the exception of one son who became a banker. So going on through the story here, at 14, Dickens was back in school. He was trying to let the other boys know that he'd been, you know, in a factory for 2 years and practically on the streets and so forth. And he excelled at academics. He knew that education was the only hope he had. And so he worked very, very hard. But by the time he was 15, his father was back in debt, and Dickens was pulled out of school. And this time a relative stepped in, didn't want to see this boy go back to factory work, and got him a position as a junior clerk in a law firm. He was really a gopher, an errand boy. But it got him around educated people. He was using his mind. He started learning shorthand, and from there he became a clerk, a reporter in Parliament, writing down everything that was happening in the House of Commons, and then this would be translated and put into the newspapers. So he was working his way up. His mother wanted him to become a lawyer, but Dickens despised the law, and he despised what lawyers did to make people's lives more miserable than they already were. And so that's why in Bleak House he really takes apart the whole legal system in England and trounces on it. He's the author who said something about all lawyers are witless bags of air or something like that. I can't remember the exact quote. But he really meant it. He never had any use for lawyers at all. So once he made it into Parliament as a reporter, then the upward mobility continued. He was asked by a newspaper to come aboard as a political reporter because he had such a good understanding of the court system and so forth. And he began traveling throughout England to report on things that were happening because there were strikes going on. You know, the workers were in terrible condition. And so, again, this kind of an illustration showed how Dickens' whole world opened up now as he began doing this travel and this reporting. He also was the theater critic because he loved writing about theater so much. So he was also doing his own writing, and he began writing short stories and sketches and essays on the side, and these were for a while published anonymously. He'd used this little pen name of Boz, which was his nickname for one of his little brothers. And eventually, he was asked by a publisher to actually write a book. First, there had been a collection of the sketches by Boz, and then came the opportunity to write his first book, which was Pickwick Papers. So with the Pickwick Papers, he was writing about the upper classes. But Dickens always had this thing in his head. It was always there waiting in the wings. And after the success of Pickwick Papers, when he now finally had some money, when he could marry, and he married his publisher's daughter, he could have his own home in England, he also could write what he wanted to write. And he wanted to write about the poor. And he wanted to write about how poorly treated they were by the upper classes, how unfair and unjust that was, and he wanted changes to come about. Now, how are you going to do it? You know, how much power does an author actually have? Well, Dickens' pen was on fire, and the first book he wrote after Pickwick Papers was Oliver Twist, and he wrote about the lowest of the low, the workhouse orphan. There was nobody with a lower status in British society at that time, and could he get people to read it? Well, if you throw in some upper class people, then you know they'll start coming around to this because it was such an engaging tale. Even Queen Victoria, who is now on the throne, really loved Oliver Twist and probably missed a lot of the irony that was directed towards her in that book. So that story hits several notes. You know, it's not just the workhouses, it's child crime. Again, it's the exploitation of the poor by the wealthy, and on and on and on. So the filth in the streets of London, the pollution, Dickens hit that in every single book he wrote. He was a very early environmentalist, and because of him, a lot of things were cleaned up in London, including the Thames and some of the major slums in that city. Those kinds of changes didn't come about immediately. That all took time. But at least he helped get the cogs moving. And everybody, again, in England, and hopefully more, as if people read my book here in the United States, will understand how influential he was to what was happening there, how often he was quoted, how many times he was sought out by newspapers for interviews about these topics and so forth. So we know from reading Oliver Twist, you know, this very famous line, "Please, sir, I want some more," when Oliver is asking for some additional gruel. And there was this wonderful illustrator who came aboard, Cruikshank, who did these early illustrations from these books. And so people now really knew who Charles Dickens was. And the only thing I'm going to say, because I'm going to run out of time real fast, about Oliver Twist is that sometimes people think that Dickens sold out because the ending of the book has Oliver discovered as the heir to a gentleman's fortune. And what Dickens was doing there, if he had left Oliver as indeed a poor urchin, you know, a foundling orphan and nothing more, then the rich could have just dismissed that. Yeah, you know, there's God at work again. That's his station in life. But by making him, at the end, a member of the gentry, the high gentry, you know, not the middle class, the upper classes, now the rich had to say, whoa, you know, if that can happen to him, I guess that can happen to anybody. And it really got their attention. One of the first things that happened as a result of this was this was such a slow process, but changes in the workhouse system, because the upper classes got interested in them as a result of this book. And again, didn't happen all at once. It was just something, a movement that got started. Dickens was also always, as I said, very interested in street children. And this is just a picture I'm going to show you, really, of the foundling children. The kids who Dickens lived in his first home three blocks from the Foundling Hospital. Hospital meaning hospice or a shelter at that time. They had 500 boys and 500 girls. These children had all been surrendered by their mothers. Most of their mothers were unmarried servants who'd been impregnated by their masters and could never name them as the fathers. And so this charity arose to take in these children. And they were raised, the girls to be servants and the boys to be sailors, soldiers. You didn't have to. I mean, they had some choices if they didn't want to do that, but the vast majority did. And this was a charity that went on for over 100 years. And Dickens became a patron of the Foundling and wrote about it a number of times. Another of his big, big interests were the ragged schools. These were the precursors to public schools. They were Sunday schools, you know, for the working class children. There were do-gooders who wanted the children to be able to read the Bible to save their own souls. And so they would gather them on Sunday, the only day the children didn't work, and teach them their alphabet and enough so that they could read the Bible. This was a very controversial kind of thing in England, because the upper classes were so worried that if the lower classes could read, then they could read a pamphlet saying, you know, come to this demonstration, we're going to overthrow the government. You know, the very thing that had happened in France, and since that was just across the channel, the British were very sensitive about that topic, which comes to play in A Christmas Carol, and I need to rush right onto that. Here's the cover of the first edition of A Christmas Carol. It was very gloriously bound in red cloth with gilded gold letters on it. It was an expensive presentation for a book that Dickens insisted be sold at a moderate price so that the lower classes could get it too. Most of the lower classes couldn't read, but they would pitch their pennies together and find somebody who could read to them. And he's always kept the cost of that book down. This is one of the reasons that, you know, they loved him so much. The poor really considered Dickens their spokesman. They knew he made fun of them sometimes, but it was there was good nature with that. This is an illustration from it. It was illustrated in color, which is very, very unusual for that time. So how did the book come about? All right, in 1843, Dickens was 31 years old. He and his wife had been married for 6 years, and they were expecting their fifth child. That was not at all uncommon in those times, although Dickens got after her a few times. Why do you have to have so many children? You know, why do you just keep doing this? But anyway, he was not the most exemplary husband. He was very much a Victorian man, and he quickly adopted, as his income went up, more the Victorian style and manners of living and so forth. And the problem was in 1843 that even though he'd written eight books and they'd all been bestsellers, he didn't have any money. In fact, he was in debt. He also owned a news magazine, and he was an editor, and he was writing essays and so forth all the time. But he had so many expenses, because he had this big household and servants and pets, and he had all these relatives who needed help all the time. And he was very charitable. He was so charitable in his heart that he was just supporting every group that asked and every individual that asked as friends. I mean, whoever it was, you could always count on Dickens for something. And he needed to do something fast. His other books had been written in serial form and published that way, two or three chapters at a time in these news magazines. There wasn't that much money in writing, because there wasn't any copyright law at that time. So he would publish them in the newspapers or the news magazines, and then at the end they'd be published as a book, and you know, they would sell. But that was the end of it, because then every printer in America would get a pirated edition and produce their own copy, and Dickens never got any money from any of that. So he missed out on what would have been a vast fortune, and he struggled forever with money. So he needed to write something quickly. He didn't have time to do one of these big books. He needed money now. And so this is when he devised his short story. And to make sure it was going to sell, he was trying to think, you know, what can the British not resist? This is a very calculated thing, okay? And he knew what it was. It was ghosts, because this was a society that believed in the supernatural. They had seances all the time and everything. And to really make sure, because this had to be a success, not one ghost, three ghosts, okay? Three ghosts, and not just three ghosts, to really, I mean, he must have been so nervous when he was thinking about this, to really make sure, okay, we'll have an apparition from hell who comes dragging its chains, you know, to tell you something about yourself, because people believe this could happen. So that gives us Marley's ghost. So we really have four ghosts in our story here. And then, what kind of story? Well, again, the whole thing with Dickens was to soften the hearts of the rich. And so we have this character of Scrooge, who's one of literature's greatest characters. And I'm going to just read you a sentence just to remind you of how Dickens describes Scrooge. So the story begins with the words, "Marley was dead," to begin with. Marley was a former partner of Ebenezer Scrooge, and here's the quote, "a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, hard and sharp as flint, and self-contained and solitary as an oyster." And of course, he'd grown rich by hoarding every penny he ever made. He was not charitable in his heart. When people come around collecting because it's Christmas time and this is a time when you give money to charity, his response, as we so famously know, is, "Bah, humbug." And he challenges them. He says, when they say to him, "Many thousands are in want of common necessities, hundreds of thousands are in want of common comforts, sir," his response is, "Are there no prisons?" The gentleman agreed there were plenty. "And the union workhouses," demanded Scrooge, "are they still in operation?" And when the gentlemen say, "Well, yes, they are, but many would rather die than go there," something Dickens knew from his own family. "Well, if they would rather die," said Scrooge, "they'd better do it and decrease the surplus population." Okay, so there's the upper classes. And then Scrooge's nephew comes in, Fred. And Fred is trying to convince his uncle that he says here that Christmas is a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time. The only time I know of in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-up hearts freely and to think of people below them as if they really were fellow passengers to the grave. And I say, God bless it. And who is that? To Dickens, that's the idealized upper-class person who understands we're all journeying through this life together, and you give as you can. So now we know that Dickens has quite a voyage here going for Scrooge. He's going to take a real trip that night with the three ghosts, Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future. And at one point, I will just stop on Christmas present here. Let's see. There's Marley's ghost. And here we have the ghost of Christmas present, of largesse, you know, that there's plenty for everybody. But if you've read A Christmas Carol in detail, if you see it at the Rep, because they do this scene very well, there are two children under the robe of Christmas present, a boy and a girl. And sometimes readers completely miss this. They don't even notice these two characters. When Scrooge sees them, he realized they were a boy and a girl, yellow, meager, ragged, scowling, wolfish. They are clearly the poor. Appalled, he asks, "Spirit, are they yours?" "They are man's," said the spirit, looking down upon them. "This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Beware them both in all their decree, but most of all, beware this boy. For on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased." We're talking here about the French Revolution coming to the British, about guillotines in the streets of London, and because the British watched this happen in France. This is a real fear for the upper classes. "Have they no refuge or resource?" Scrooge asked with concern. "Are there no prisons?" responded the spirit, turning on him for the last time with his own words. "Are there no workhouses?" Message delivered. All right, by the time Scrooge wakes up, his hard heart has indeed softened. He pleads with the final spirit, the spirit of Christmas future, to give him one more chance, to let him prove that he has learned his lesson. He says, "I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year. I will live in the past, the present, and the future. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. I shall not shut out the lessons that they teach." And he awakes on Christmas morning and he has another chance. And so you know the rest of the story. He sends the boy to get the prize turkey in the window of the butcher's shop and sends it to Bob Cratchit's family. and what Dickens did in the stroke of his pen when he wrote Prize Turkey instead of Prize Goose was he changed Christmas forever in Great Britain and put the goose business practically out of business because now everybody wanted turkeys. And that has survived in England. They have turkey at Christmas. So that's directly from Dickens. In fact, Dickens is often given credit for reviving what once was a very festive holiday in England, Christmas, but which Cromwell and the Puritans had outlawed, and it was supposed to be a day of reflection and a very quiet day, but a day of charity. It always had been a day of charity. Dickens' family had always celebrated Christmas, and a lot of people did, and they did it with feasting and merriment and so forth, but they were the minority. So after this book was published, Christmas was back, back big time with turkey. So we know that what's happened to Scrooge, I mean, there's this whole story of redemption here. That's the basis of this, that it's never too late for a second chance. So the question becomes, did the British hear that part of it? And when the book came out, Dickens actually had put up his own money for the first printing. His publishers thought he was crazy because this was an expensive book, you know, the gilded lettering and so forth, and they thought they'd take a real beating on this. And besides, it was a short story, you know, who writes those or reads them? So Dickens now, because he'd gone even further into debt for this, had everything at stake. It really was the greatest risk of his career. And they published 6,000 copies of it. It came out a week before Christmas, this in 1843. Dickens wrote this story in 6 weeks. And Dickens held his breath to see if anybody would buy it because it was so different. He'd never done anything like this before. And then the first review came out proclaiming it a tale to make the reader laugh and cry, open his hands and open his heart to charity. And that was it. People were lining up, and they were very quickly in a second printing, and on it went from there. So the book turned out to be a huge success. Ministers would read from it from the pulpit, and people would give more money. There were several factory owners who gave their workers an extra day off, which was an extraordinary thing. There's this whole long list of things that happened as a direct result. Dickens was forevermore, the rest of his life, asked to read this story aloud. People loved it so much. And he actually, these are still from A Christmas Carol, he actually made a good living doing that. He'd done it for charity forever, this reading aloud. But once these money problems kept cropping up, and so he started doing it to not only give money to charity, but to pay himself as well. And he really worked himself too hard. He died at age 58 of overwork. I mean, it was technically a heart attack. By then, he was separated from his wife, and that's quite a story. And I don't tell the 10-year-olds that story too much. And his companion was an 18-year-old, started at age 18. She was 18 when Dickens was 48, which is when this started. And she was his companion the rest of his life and was with him when he died. It's possible they had a child together. Nobody's ever been quite able to prove that because the child would have died probably at birth. So that's sort of the story of a Christmas Carol. I mean, I say sort of. I could have gone into a lot of other detail, but I just wanted to tell you the basics, and I think it's time for some questions, and I hope you have some because I love to talk about Dickens.
You're listening to local author Andrea Warren talking about Charles Dickens and his times. We owe you a few messages. Let's take a break from the program for a minute or two, and we'll come back with a relatively short question and answer period for you. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
I'm Wendy from Edged in Blue, that rockin' little blues show. Starting September 16th, please join me on Fridays from 3 to 5 p.m. for a mix of rock and blues. That's Fridays 3 to 5 p.m. starting September 16th.
Hi, we're the Voodoo Kittens. I'm Stray Cat.
I'm Miss Catnip.
And I'm the old Alley Cat.
And we bring you the best of blues on KKFI every Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 5:30.
So keep your dial tuned to 90.1 KKFI or listen online at kkfi.org.
And we all thank you.
Do you have an old car, a truck, motorcycle, or boat that you're ready to part with? Contact Bill at 816-931-931. 3122 to find out how your donation could be very helpful to KKFI. That's 816-931-3122, and ask to speak with Bill.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel from the Heartland Labor Forum, wishing all of our KKFI listeners a happy holidays. And we especially send out our greetings to all those workers in retail shops and stores who are often low paid and stressed out. We hope you all have a happy holiday season too.
Hello, Kansas City. This is Rebecca, host of Eclectics. Only KKFI Kansas City Community Radio gives you this eclectic mix of music. This program is the original. Eclectics will take you all over the world, across the universe, and even back to Kansas City with all types of music. Listen to real variety, the way radio should be. Eclectics, now on Fridays from 10 to noon.
Want to learn about what's going on in the Kansas City theater scene? Want to learn about what show you might like to attend? Join me, Michael Hogue, for the Arts Magazine program Mondays at 12 o'clock noon, right here on KKFI. We'll keep you fully informed.
Hey, I'm Nick Spitzer, host of American Roots. Each week, we bring you music and artist interviews from across the American soundscape. Blues and jazz, old-time country and gospel, roots rock and soul, Zydeco, Tejano, and beyond. Join me on the journey on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Wednesday nights from 7:30 to 9:30, right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.
LGBTQIA, 1 p.m. on Saturday, music, news, and interviews. This is what you ought to do. Tune to 90.1 FM, Saturdays at 1 p.m.
The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
Hi, I'm Jason Pavone, host of KKFI's new blues show, The Boogie Bridge. Join me every Thursday afternoon starting at 3 p.m. for an afternoon of all the good stuff. Like the motto says, it's all killer, no filler. At The Boogie Bridge, Thursdays 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., 90.1 FM KKFI or KKFI.org.
Is democracy in the workplace possible? In the spirit of Peace for Christmas, the Heartland Labor Forum is going to replay Mondragon, Humanity at Work. Mondragon in Spain is the world's largest industrial democracy, where workers elect the CEO and profits are distributed to the worker owners. They now operate in 28 countries. That's Thursday, Christmas Day at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Hey, this is Barry Jackson, your fusion funkmeister. You like George Duke, Tower Power, Billy Cobham? Or in other words, if you like that edgy sound of fusion, or that old school funk and soul, tune into the Tuesday Midday Medley. That's Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. on the Tuesday Midday Medley right here on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station, or at KKFI.org.
A little spare time? Always wanted to be in radio? Well, then come on down and get involved in your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI. On the air or behind the scenes, we need your help, and it's lots of fun, too. For more information, call Bill at the KKFI offices at 816-994-7869.
Do we have anyone now who is having this much of an influence and an impact on society in a positive way, either in the United States or in Britain?
I wish I could say yes. Nobody comes to mind. I don't know if somebody, if one of you are thinking of something. I will add on to that Dickens continues to be important today for his reading. He's still, for his writing, his books are still quoted. They were a worldwide success during the Civil War. More Dickens was carried in soldiers' knapsacks than any other author, and whoever could read would read around the campfire. Other soldiers who couldn't read would be there to listen to the stories. He was more popular in Russian than the great Russian novelist, but I don't know somebody comparable to that kind of storytelling today.
This story has been filmed in various iterations a lot. Do you have a favorite that you think really captures, or a couple of favorites that capture the essence of this story?
That's a good question. The one that I know best is the George C. Scott Scrooge. I know that actors love to do Dickens. I wish they could turn what they do at the Rep into a movie. I think it would be a great one. Oliver is here in town right now, the musical, and I just saw that, and that's really wonderful, too. It brings us right back to the workhouse and Oliver Twist. So I'm just going to answer the question, I'm going to go with George C. Scott. He's the one I tend to think of myself, and there are a lot of Dickens movies out there. I mean, that's one way to get acquainted with these stories. The stories are so long, you know, because, again, they were done in serial fashion, and they were meant to be read aloud.
Thank you very much for the enlightenment in the season. And as you were talking, I was thinking about the number of words he penned, wondering, is there a connection, or how might we understand, excuse me, why he was so verbose, shall we say, or at least wrote a lot of words? Was that an artifact of the audience, of the publishing style? And I think it might go back to the earlier question about, you know, in the age of 140 character, yeah, complete ideas, we may never see another Dickens.
You know, you have to envision the Victorian age, the dim lighting at night. London was basically a dark city. A lot of the poor areas of the slum had no light at all. And so what would happen in families in the evening is, you know, you'd sit by the lantern or the gaslight and someone would read aloud. And they'd read everything. They'd read the Bible, they'd read the newspaper, and they'd read Dickens. And so he again, wrote in long style, in part because that was his livelihood, but also because he had such a love of words. I've got a whole section in the book about the names he uses. So creative, and the couple thousand characters that he invented. So his stories all have long spin-offs. This is where students who have to read them and read them quickly and then take a test on them go a little crazy. And that was me in graduate school and not really appreciating what I was reading. But if you will take time at some point to listen to something, a book on tape with Dickens, you know, and somebody really good doing it, you'll, I think, gain a new appreciation for the language. It's really beautiful, but it's time-consuming. And that was indeed a factor of the age and this idea that books were meant to be read aloud because so many people couldn't read or because that was your entertainment in the evenings, both things. That's the best answer I can really give.
I'm curious, how much accuracy is there to the relationship that he had with the young woman and his conduct with his wife in terms of his lack of charity and love and generosity? Because from what I've read about Dickens, his behavior in his interior relationship was horrible. And his emotional connection with his true love was quite binding. And I'm wondering, is there any fact to that, or is that just, you know...
Yeah, there's a lot of fact to that, in part because of things that his children have revealed later about their father. You know, their father never talked ever about the time as a bootblack. This is something that they learned after he died. One of Dickens' best friends knew about it and also was the holder of the bit of autobiography Dickens had written. That was such a horrifying event for him, and it made him a very, very controlled person. I already spoke about how well-dressed he was. He hated debt. He above all things, that was it. I mean, always in control. He ran his house like clockwork. On the, you know, the dinner had to be served at a certain time. The breakfast had to be served at a certain time. The children were meant to be seen and not heard. He really loved his children. He would play with them and so forth, but as they got older, he got more distant
from them. And he really could do that. He could really withdraw his affection. His wife was a sweet young thing. He was 24 when he married her, and she was 18. And she just absolutely adored him. There was no question about that. She was crazy about him. And he seemed to be in the early years about her. But he grew apart in terms of his affection to the point, there's two sides to everybody, and there certainly is this other side of Dickens. So I've told you all the good things and the incredible things he did for society and continues to do in society today. But the truth is that when he felt that he and his wife were no longer meant to be together, I think their oldest child was 19 by then, and they still had a six-year-old. He had carpenters come and build a wall in their bedroom. And so he was on one side and she was on the other side. He couldn't divorce her because it would so have adversely affected his career, because you just couldn't divorce in those days. And you had to do it through a court of law, and you had to prove this and prove that and, you know, have witnesses. And, I mean, it was really a nasty, negative thing. So he separated, and then he lived apart. He kept the nice big family home, and his wife had her own place. She was very brokenhearted, but she stayed very loyal to him the rest of his life. She outlived him, never said a bad word about him. The mistress was also completely silent on the topic. There was a movie out last year that Ralph Fiennes was in. He played Dickens. I'm not thinking of The Invisible Woman, I think, might have been the title of it, based on a book. And the story very much focused on Ellen Tiernan, this young woman. Dickens always liked young women. When he and his wife married, the wife's younger sister came to live with them. And when she was 17, she died in their house with Dickens holding her hand. I can't remember now, but it was one of those diseases that were so common at that time. And thereafter, he just sort of had this fixation. You know, he'd go to the girl's grave and weep, and he kept all her clothes, kind of weird, you know, just, but 17-year-olds. Whenever I hear that song, "When I Was 17, it was a very good year," I think of Charles Dickens now. So Ellen was 18 and an actress, which might have meant she, you know, was one of those women. But she also traveled with her mother and sisters, and they were a traveling troupe. And they were all, that was all very proper. The mother was always around. I think she really loved Dickens, and she never, ever used that to exploit him in any way. So, yes, he could be very hard, yes. There was a soft side to him, too. I mean, that's the best I can say. There was a meeting of the two. Yeah.
I've read and seen some film this stuff about Dickens, that he was quite close to one of his daughters. Is that true, or is that just another myth?
So of those eight surviving children, I think there were only two daughters. And one daughter was an artist. His daughters stayed very close to their father. They're the ones who continued to live with him. They weren't the only ones, incidentally. His wife, I said her one sister had died in their home. Well, she had another sister, Georgiana, who lived with the Dickens. And when this split came, she chose sides and she went with Dickens against her sister, and remained as the nanny, literally, to the children, sometimes the tutor. She sort of filled in, I'll say his wife, but I only mean in the sense that she ran the household, that's all I mean, and helped with the children. Probably she was in love with him, too. You know, supposedly he was a really charming guy and a great speaker and had this very cultured way about him that he'd gotten from his father, and there you are. You know, there's a lot we'll never know because he never wrote about it. You know, he'd write about everybody else, but not about himself. Yeah.
Thank you. It's very good what you're saying. Thanks. I'd just like to mention The Muppets Christmas Carol as a version you might have seen with Michael Caine. It's one of the entertaining ones. But my real question is, could you say something about his effect upon the reform movement and maybe upon the ruling class of Britain, Queen Victoria or so forth? Thank you.
Well, Queen Victoria loved Charles Dickens. And so one of the interesting little anecdotes about this is that Queen Victoria, a couple of times, well, okay, so when Pickwick Papers came out, what happens is this group of noblemen in this story who never have to work because they're rich, go to Rochester, England, which is Dickens grew up in a little town, Chatham, near there. And Dickens always put real places so they're in his books. So there's a real inn, for example, and the men stay at that inn. Well, Queen Victoria
went and stayed in this inn. I mean, she did sort of did her Dickens trip, following through, seeing the places he had seen and that kind of thing. And there were several times that she summoned him to come read to her or perform for her. Dickens was always an actor all his life. He wrote a lot of plays, he wrote an opera, he wrote poetry, and he loved to perform, and she would want this command performance. Now, who's going to turn down the Queen of England, right? Charles Dickens, that's who. And he's probably the only one who ever did it, at least on record. And he did it several times. He had absolutely no use for the upper classes. His own friends were artists, actors primarily, other writers. He was very, very generous to other writers, helping them, publishing their work, advising them, that kind of thing. But when it came to the upper classes, they all wanted to hobnob. They all were inviting him constantly to come to things because, you know, then that would be reflected glory on them, because everybody of every class loved Charles Dickens. He couldn't walk down the street without... I mean, it wasn't like today where people would try to rip your clothes, but that happened, incidentally, when he visited America. But in Britain, they were very respectful, and they would doff a hat or say hello and that kind of thing. But they wouldn't beg, not there. They would send him letters. Dickens called them begging letters. He got basketfuls of them every day. And even if he chose not to help somebody by sending them money, he would at least send back a note, and it would have his signature, and that was worth money. And people knew it. He did so many charitable things, and often anonymously. I can't even get into it. There's so much, because that's just how he was. So at this point, I've lost the original question. It had to do with. I'm sorry, I really have. the upper classes. Okay, so he never did embrace them, and he ridicules them constantly in his book and his books. He never changed that ever. He was consistent all the way through. When he died, he wanted to be buried in the graveyard at Rochester, England, where they have one of the great Dickens festivals, and I've been to it. And the government overruled the family. The family wanted to do what Dickens wanted. He wanted to be buried in that graveyard. His parents were there and so forth. And the government said, Westminster Abbey, you know. And so he is buried in Westminster Abbey, right next to Handel, the great German-British composer, who's in my book, incidentally. Very, very charitable man himself. And he has a very plain grave. It simply has his name. Some of them have a lot of carvings on it. And I asked somebody at Westminster Abbey, I said, why is this just his name on this, you know, why didn't you do something fancy for him? And I got this long, convoluted thing about, well, you know, jealousy, and you can't favor one, and then blah, blah. And I go, but look at these others you've got. They go, well, you know, so I really can't tell you why that was.
You didn't mention anything about his religious experience, and Unitarians love to claim people. And
yes.
We claim Charles Dickens. Is that wishful thinking on our part?
I'm so glad that question came up with Unitarians. There was indeed a time when Dickens identified himself as a Unitarian, but if he couldn't divorce his wife, he also really couldn't say he wasn't a member of the Church of England, because everybody was a member of the Church of England. And the question will also come up, did Dickens believe in God? Well, he did in the sense that people did in that day, that he would talk about it, you know, and somebody might pray, there could be a minister in his story. But it seemed real clear that he didn't have a real good relationship with this God who allowed so many people to suffer so much. And in spirit, I don't think there's any question but that he was a Unitarian. He did, however, if you go looking through the things he's written, one of the things he did was he wrote a book of Bible stories for his own children to help them understand the Bible, because he thought it was too complex for children. So there's that about him too, but he was never a great professor of faith. A lot of that, I think, was just lip service. He was a Unitarian at heart.
Thank you very much.
Our topic on this special Christmas Eve show of the All Souls Forum is why Charles Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol, with local author Andrea Warren. She's the author of the best-selling Charles Dickens and the Street Children of London. This program was recorded on Sunday, December 7th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited each week for broadcast by Barry Lee. The theme music you're hearing is composed and performed by local artist Fred Potter. Thanks to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help in producing this program each week. Tune in again next week for another All Souls Forum right here at the same time, same place on KKFI. And on behalf of the All Souls Church and KKFI, we wish you happy holidays and hope you enjoyed this program. Tune in again next Wednesday at noon for another All Souls Forum. In the meantime, of course, you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.